If you have your Bibles this morning, I invite you to turn to the book of Daniel, chapter 3. Before I read, I want to pose some thoughts for you to consider. We live in a results-oriented, almost results-driven culture. Sometimes, in many segments, the idea is it doesn't matter what you do as long as you succeed. Get the right results at any cost and under any circumstance and by any means. Not exactly a biblical philosophy, is it? And let me be very personal. Almost 7 years ago, after having lost my mother in my late adolescence to cancer, almost having lost my wife when she was 29 and 30 to cancer, I had prayed over my lifetime, "Lord, whatever I face in the future, let it be whatever, but please not the C word." And I had to sit in a doctor's office and hear that I had been diagnosed with the C word. It was a very shocking circumstance. Chose surgery, doctor. When you go to Loma Linda, which is a medical school hospital, you stand in line and take a number. If I had gone through the normal routine at Loma Linda, they would have probably waited 2 or 3 months before I was able to have my surgery. As the doctor finished up and called in the scheduling nurse, finished up with our interview and discussion, and I told him I wanted to have surgery as my option, the scheduling nurse said, "It'll probably be 2 or 3 months unless, and there may be an opening in 2 weeks. We won't know for sure till tomorrow, but I'll call you." So we went through everything, you know, hoping for the 2 week schedule. Call next day, everything's worked out. You're scheduled for 2 weeks. Come in and here's the routine and here's how to get ready. Went through the surgery. Doctor came in 2 days later with a pathology report. My cancer was at a moderate stage, but had already started turning to the aggressive stage. This is a cancer urologic specialist at Loma Linda, teaching doctor, one of the leading doctors in the hospital. Very solemnly looked at me and said, "You, sir, are very fortunate to have come to us when you did." Later, in a subsequent visit in his office, he gave me his assessment. Within 2 weeks to two to three months, that cancer that had turned aggressive would have blown out of my prostate and spread through my body. As I woke up in the recovery room, the fear that I had lived with had been taken away. I'm pushing 7 years. All of my tests have been positive. I was blessed to find one of the best surgeons in Southern California for my problem. And I could not possibly have hoped for the outcome I experienced. What God gave me in the recovery room was the understanding God is good. Whatever happens from this point forward, good or bad, and I didn't know what to expect at that point, I would not have to face it alone. The Lord would be with me. And that gave me comfort. In the last couple of 3 years, I've experienced my second in my entire life, for crying out loud. I've been incredibly healthy and blessed with good health. My second health episode, I slowly began to realize that I was probably facing major surgery. And back surgery is, in many circles, has not progressed to the degree of sophistication as other medical processes. I was blessed again to find a very skilled surgeon. And this last week, the head of the physical therapy office where I'm going for rehab came in to see me. You normally see him at the beginning of therapy and at the end, hello and goodbye. He comes in the middle of my therapy and asks how I'm doing, and then he says, "Joe, you need to know that every therapist who's worked with you is astounded at how well you're doing so soon after surgery. I can't complain about my results, can I? Anything but. I feel like the Lord has richly blessed my two episodes. Here's the point. In either case, what if the results had been the mirror opposite? Would I have been justified in concluding that God was any less good because my cancer got out of control, because I found the wrong doctor who botched my back surgery and I lived with more pain afterwards than before? Would that have changed the character of God? Of course not. That's what I'm talking about with our focus, our obsession with results-driven assessments. In Daniel 3, a miracle occurs. Three faithful Jews refuse to break God's first and perhaps most important commandment. They are sentenced to an immediate death penalty in a fiery furnace. I think if I dread anything more than cancer, it's fire. let me die anyway, but please not by fire, right? You know, it's just the most awful thing in the world to think about. They're delivered. We go to the Inquisition of Europe during the Middle Ages, and hundreds, thousands of Christians, no less faithful than these three Jews, were burned at the stake for their faith. Was God any less faithful in the Inquisition for those Christians than he was for these three Jews? Was he any less good? No. So how do we deal with all of this? Must we measure our faith based on outcome, based on results, based on what paves the golden path of convenience and ease for us? Or is there something more important that God uses and we should use to measure the outcome of our faith? That's my question for you this morning. Let me read, beginning with the first verse of Daniel chapter 3. Nebuchadnezzar, the king, made an image of gold whose height was 60 cubits and the breadth thereof 6 cubits. He set it up in the plain of Dura in the province of Babylon. A cubit is basically measured from the tip of your longest finger to your elbow, roughly 18 inches. So 60 cubits would be roughly 90 feet tall. That's 9 stories high, 9 feet wide. First of all, if it's solid gold, that is one big stack of gold. He must have been pretty well off to have had that much gold available to make the statue, right? Even if he made it out of wood or some other material and plated it with gold, it's still a lot of gold. I want you to keep something in mind. In the second chapter, Nebuchadnezzar has a dream. He forgets the dream, but he wants to know the dream and its meaning. In the dream, as Daniel interpreted it to him, Nebuchadnezzar has a dream, and he sees in his dream an image. The head is gold. The shoulders and arms, silver. The torso, brass. The legs, iron. Daniel's interpretation to Nebuchadnezzar is this: as with all earthly kingdoms that have ever existed and that shall ever exist, no world government or kingdom lasts forever. They all reach the point of implosion and are replaced or overcome by another. Nebuchadnezzar, you're the head of gold. You're gold, not silver or brass, but your kingdom shall come to an end. Gold's more valuable than silver. Silver more valuable than brass, and brass more than iron. Civil government tends to degenerate over time. Nebuchadnezzar celebrates the fact that he's heard the dream and that Daniel has interpreted it for him. It has to appeal to his ego that he's the head of gold. Babylon, the superior to any kingdom that shall follow. But we see in chapter 3 the depth of Nebuchadnezzar's self-absorption. He's not content to be a head of gold. He wants to be the head of a kingdom that lasts forever and is not replaced by another. So he wants to make his own image after his ego, after his desire. And instead of being gold, silver, brass, and iron, one kingdom replaced by another, head to toe, all gold. Beginning to end, from now till the end of time, Babylon rules. We see a lot about the old man's thinking here, don't we? Yes, he does. Paul will describe the character of the wicked in Philippians chapter 3 when he says their God is their belly. They are consumed with self. They worship themselves. Don't forget, the Pharisee and the publican who prayed in Jesus' analogy. How did the Pharisee pray? Jesus says he prayed. What do you do when you pray? You talk to your God, right? He prayed thus with himself. Who's his God? Self is his God. He's talking to himself. Self is God. That's the state of Nebuchadnezzar's mind. Okay, let's continue reading. Then Nebuchadnezzar, the king, sent together the princes, the governors, the captains, the judges, the treasurers, the counselors, the sheriffs, and all the rulers of the provinces to come to the dedication of the image which Nebuchadnezzar, the king, had set up. Then the princes, the governors, the captains, the judges, the treasurers, the counselors, the sheriffs, and all the rulers of the provinces were gathered together unto the dedication of the image that Nebuchadnezzar the king had set up. And they stood before the image that Nebuchadnezzar had set up. Sounds like inauguration, doesn't it? Everybody of any significance is supposed to show up and be seen on television, right? Then Herod cried aloud, "To you it is commanded, O people, nations, and languages, that at what time ye hear the sound of the cornet, flute, harp, sackbut, psaltery, dulcimer, and all kinds of music," then he had the orchestra gathered too, "ye fall down and worship the golden image that Nebuchadnezzar the king has set up." If you worship the king and the king's image, who are you really worshiping? The king, right? "And whoso falleth not down and worshipeth shall the same hour be cast into the midst of a burning fiery furnace. Therefore, at that time, when all the people heard the sound of the cornet, flutes, harp, sackbut, psaltery, and all kinds of music, all the people, the nations, the languages, fell down and worshipped the golden image that Nebuchadnezzar the king had set up." Well, almost all. "Wherefore at that time certain Chaldeans came near and accused the Jews. They spake and said to King Nebuchadnezzar, O king, live forever. Thou, O king, hast made a decree that every man that shall hear the sound of the..." And we go through all... the list goes on right ad nauseum. "Shall fall down and worship the golden image. And whosoever falleth not down and worshipeth that... that he should be cast into the midst of a burning, fiery furnace. There are certain Jews whom thou hast set over the affairs of the province of Babylon, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego." One of the few lessons, maybe the only lesson in Daniel, that does not include the presence of Daniel in the lesson, that his three friends, men of faith, men of faithfulness to their God, as we see in the first chapter, are the focus of this particular lesson. "These men, O king, have not regarded thee. They serve not thy gods, nor worship the golden image which thou hast set up." Then Nebuchadnezzar, in his rage and fury, commanded to bring Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. Then they brought these men before the king. someone like Nebuchadnezzar doesn't want to be embarrassed, and heaven help you if you do embarrass him. You're going to be the recipient of his unbridled rage. Nebuchadnezzar spake and said unto them, "Is it true, O Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, do not ye serve my gods, nor worship the golden image which I have set up?" Nebuchadnezzar, go back to the first chapter of Daniel. What does it say? What did you experience with these men? Go to the second chapter. Have you forgotten your vision and Daniel's explanation and the fact that Daniel requested that these three men be promoted as faithful servants of the king because they worshipped another god from your gods? How soon they forget. Now, if you be ready, that at what time ye hear the sound of the, and go through the musical instruments again, you fall down and worship the image which I have made, well, but if ye worship not, ye shall be cast the same hour into the midst of a burning fiery furnace. And who is that God that shall deliver you out of my hands? Blatantly, Nebuchadnezzar elevates himself above God. You don't have a God. No God exists that can deliver you out of my hands. Whoever in the past ever built a 90-foot statue of gold to honor him and to command worship of him, if I did that, I'm bigger than your God, fellas. Who's going to deliver you out of my hand? You're smoke. You're toast. Shadrach, Meshach, and I want you to watch carefully the attitude and the response these three men had. It is so enlightening. Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego answered and said to the king, "O Nebuchadnezzar, we are not careful to answer thee in this matter." They didn't say we are careful. We are not careful to answer thee in this matter. We're very bold. We're very clear about the issue. If it be so, our God, whom we serve, is able to deliver us from the burning fiery furnace, and he will deliver us out of thine hand, O king. Our God's bigger than you. But if it be so, but if not, be it known unto thee, O king, that we will not serve thy gods, nor worship the golden image which thou hast set up. Okay, look at these men carefully. They know the character of their God. It's interesting, in the New Testament, Paul in Ephesians chapter 6 says, "Children, obey your parents in the Lord, for this is the first commandment with promise." If you go to Exodus chapter 20, you can read God's Ten Commandments as he first dictated them to Moses. You can read number 1, 2, 3, all the way down to 10. There is only one commandment that says if you'll obey this commandment, there's a promise of special or unique blessing. Honor your father and your mother, that your days may be prolonged, and that it may be well with you upon the earth. No other commandment comes with a promise of unique blessing. Only the commandment to honor family, parents. There's another unique commandment, however, in the list. The very first takes up four whole verses. It's the most extensive commandment described out of the ten. Some of them, thou shalt not kill. That's the way God gave it to Moses, period. But when God described idolatry and forbade it, he went into an extensive description. You shall not do this. And he went into great detail. Make a note to check that commandment in Exodus chapter 20. Begins with the very second verse. Reads down through verse 6. Okay, here's the pull. Here's the stress. They're living with full knowledge of what God said about idolatry. What God said about idolatry says that image is made up of gold and it'll melt like any other gold. It's not a god, it's a piece of gold. There's no god there, it's gold, that's all. Gold is nice, but it's gold, it's not a god. Do we bow down? Do we just kind of pretend? Well, we're under pressure. We're down in Babylon. Let's try to save our lives and be a good witness at another time. Or do we stand the ground? You smell the fire. You feel some of the heat. This is one hot furnace. You want to be thrown in that immediately if you don't do it? Or if you get thrown in the flames, you're not going to be able to be a witness for God. You'll die, for crying out loud. Why don't you preserve your life and be a witness on another day? Yeah, human rationalization can just go in any direction we want to take it and justify anything we want to justify, right? How well it works and how wrongly. We don't know what God will do. We know God is able to deliver us from the fire and from you, O King. But even if God doesn't deliver us, O King, even if we're thrown into the fire, our God said, don't worship idols, and we will honor His commandment even if it means our death. These men are not results-driven. They're God-driven. Big difference. A world of difference. Verse 19, then was Nebuchadnezzar full of fury. The form of his visage was changed against Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. He was so mad his face changed. Do you ever see somebody just, when I grew up in the deep south, they called it spitting mad. Have you ever seen anyone just so stinking mad, they suddenly take on a distorted view, their face gets contorted, and you see the veins in their forehead and temples, and the veins bulge out in their neck, and they're beet red, if not purple, and their mouth distorts, and their eyes are shooting out flames almost, and man, they are mad. They don't even look like they do when they're not mad. Well, you got a king who has a lot of power that mad at these people. Therefore he spake and commanded that they should heat the furnace 1/7 times more than it was wont to be. It is not hot enough. Fire it up. Pour more fuel on. Get it hotter. You read the lesson. The men who took these three Jews to throw them into the furnace, the fire is so hot it kills them as they take them up to throw them into the mouth of the furnace. Verse 23. These three men, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, fell down bound into the midst of the burning fiery furnace. Then Nebuchadnezzar, the king, was astonished. There's something troubling him. He doesn't feel totally in control here, does he? He's not. He rose up in haste and spake and said unto his counselors, did not we cast three men bound into the midst of the fire? They answered and said unto the king, true, O king. He answered and said, lo, I see four men loose, walking in the midst of the fire, and they have no hurt. And the form of the fourth is like the Son of God. Wait a minute. This fire is so hot, it kills the soldiers who are taking these three men to throw them into the fire, but it doesn't kill them. They fall in. The king looks in. They're bound when they're thrown in. He looks in. They're not bound. They're not hurt by fire. But the greatest surprise this king discovers when he looks in is that he threw three men in, and he sees four men walking free like they're taking a stroll in a meadow, not bothered one bit by the fire. Who's the fourth man? Who is the fourth man? He's the Lord. Yes, indeed. He's the Lord. Now, by the way, lest you get too high an opinion of good old Nebi, look at verse 28. Then Nebuchadnezzar spake and said, blessed be the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, who has sent his angel and delivered his servants that trusted in him. Change the king's word. This man doesn't change. He is not changed. But God would not allow him to ignore what he saw. Isn't that powerful? That is neat stuff. Now, here's these men, despite all that they face and all that comes upon them, they are delivered. God had this day to be their day of testimony, not to be testified by their death, but by their deliverance and life. Now, go back to the question I raised with you at the beginning. And keep your place here, but turn to the book of Hebrews, chapter 11. The heroes of faith. For the first 35 verses, we have at the beginning a detailed list, including the experience of Old Testament people who by faith survived trials, were faithful under pressure, and in moments of intense difficulty were empowered to honor God. If you read about these men in the Old Testament, you will primarily be reading the book of Genesis. And then, beginning, you get into the book of Joshua. And let's start reading with verse 32. And what shall I more say? For the time would fail me to tell of Gideon, Barak, Samson, you're getting into Judges, Jephthah and David, whoops, we're over a little further, and Samuel, and of the prophets. He says, you know, if I gave you this kind of detail on all of these people, I wouldn't have enough time. I wouldn't have enough ink and paper to write down the narrative of all of them. Who through faith subdued kingdoms, wrought righteousness, obtained promises, stopped the mouths of lions. We'll get to that in Daniel later. Quenched the violence of fire. We're studying that today, are we not? Escaped the edge of the sword, out of weakness were made strong, waxed valiant in fight, turned to flight the armies of the aliens, women received their dead raised to life again. There are some instances of individual resurrections in the Old Testament. It's easy to read about these people and see the victory of faith. Right? No problem. It's not so easy to see the same truth in the verses and examples that follow. Let's look at them. And verse 35, middle of the verse, and others were tortured, not accepting deliverance, that they might obtain a better resurrection. Others had trial of cruel mockings and scourgings. Yea, moreover, of bonds and imprisonment. They were stoned. They were sawn asunder. There's a Jewish tradition that because Isaiah was so faithful in his testimony against the wicked king of his day, that eventually to shut him up, they stuffed Isaiah in a hollow log and then sawed the log in two, which meant they sawed his body in half and killed him in a torturous death. They were tempted. They were slain with the sword. They wandered about in sheepskins and goatskins, being destitute, afflicted, tormented, of whom the world was not worthy. Wait a minute. We're talking about heroes of faith. We're talking about victors of faith. How do these people fit in? We understand with Moses. We understand with Abraham. We understand with Noah. But how do these men fit in? By human standard, by performance criteria, they lost. They lost their lives. How can they be testimonials of the victory of faith? They are. You see, victory for God is not measured by our criteria. It's interesting. In fact, I've used it this way, so I'm not going to be too critical. I can't without slamming my own toes. In the book of Philippians, think this is either the third or fourth chapter, third, I believe. Paul says, if we want to get into a bragging contest, I'll win the contest every time. I have more plaques on my wall. I have more degrees, more certificates of merit and honor than any of you have in my religion. But he said all those things when I came to see the man from Galilee, I tore him off the wall and put him in storage. No, I didn't put him in storage. I threw them. I flushed them down the toilet. He uses language that rather specifically makes that point. And then interestingly, he says, this one thing I do, forgetting those things which are past and reaching for those things which are before. I've used this passage when I was counseling with someone who just went through some kind of personal failure. And a spouse walked away. They lost their job. Maybe they lost their job because they didn't perform their job well. Maybe the spouse left because they were inconsiderate and unthoughtful about that person. They felt a sense of guilt for what had come upon them. Well, what can you tell a person, forget it? It doesn't matter that your life is in the ruins because of your own mistakes. You can't really say that, can you? You can't go back and unscramble the egg either, can you? So what do you do? Okay, the only thing you can do from this day forward is forget the past and try to be better in the future. Learn from your mistakes and do better. And I quote this passage, forgetting those things which are behind. Contextually, that is not what Paul is saying here. What does Paul say he himself forgot? He forgot all his accomplishments. He forgot all his merit badges. He forgot all his diplomas. He forgot all of his awards that were hanging all over the wall. He forgot all of his successes. Because the one thing that was worth winning in his life didn't show up as something he could hang on the wall. It was the smile of a Savior who said, Paul, well done. Forgetting all of your successes, press forward to please him. These people were willing to face torture and death because it honored their God. The alternative would have been denying their faith. The stories from medieval Europe abound. Fox's Book of Martyrs may not be a very accurate history, but it is in all likelihood a fairly accurate account of a large number of faithful Christians who were faced with torture and remained faithful. I recall a story of a young lady, perhaps in her late teens, early 20s. She had been caught with evidence that she was a Christian, but she didn't fit into the normal routine of the day, and so she was subject to persecution. She was actually bound and tied to the stake and the fire placed around her. The wood. The fire's in their hands. Will you deny your faith? And this young woman, not this decrepit old man, this young woman looked at her accusers and said, Sirs, my Lord has been faithful to me every step I've taken. My God has stood by me through every trial of my life. Not one time has He ever deserted or forsaken me. Can I now forsake Him? They lit the fire, and she died at the stake, praising God, not crying out because of the pain of fire. Was she any less delivered from the fire than these three men? Did she any less glorify God by her death at fire than these men by their deliverance from fire? the story is told of one of the promoters of an English Bible who was accused and put on the same situation. They had actually put him to the point where they were lighting the fire, and the fire was beginning to burn and beginning to heat up his body, and he was tied around the torso, his hands were loose. And they kept saying, "Will you deny your faith? Will you stop promoting the printing of Bibles in the English language?" And he kept refusing and refusing, and finally he saw a large flame coming up just to his right-hand side, and he stuck his finger out right in the flame. And the flame continued heating his finger until they could smell burning flesh and see flame coming from the end of his finger, burning his finger. And yet he was not flinching with pain. And he said, "I will never deny my Lord nor my faith in Him and the need of His people to have a Bible in their language that they can know Him and honor Him by what it teaches them." He died. But he died praising God, not complaining at the pain of fire. Are these men any less heroes of faith? No. Would my God have been any less a good God if I was in the grave today or walking in a walker today? No. No. There's an interesting passage in Revelation. I think you'll find this in the 5th chapter. John says, "I saw the martyrs, people who had died for their faith. I saw the souls of the martyrs under the altar. And they said, 'Lord, how long till you avenge our death? We were killed, suffered for our faith. When will justice come?'" And the Lord's answer to them is kind of a surprise. You have to struggle with it to make sense of it. Not yet. Some more martyrs are going to have to die. Some more time will pass. Here's a white robe. Wear your white robe and enjoy me till the right time comes. That's not the answer they expected, is it? More martyrs? More people yet to die? We think we live in an enlightened world, an enlightened age when people are not put to death for their Christianity. Folks, more people have died for their faith in the 20th and 21st centuries than died in the Inquisition. Go to Africa, where families are broken up and young boys and girls are stolen from their family and tortured because of their faith. Some of them have died. Many, many of them have died. In the nation of China, The growth of professing sincere Christians is growing faster than in any other nation today. And yet the entire Christian community in China, the robust, true Christian community, is growing underground in the presence of a hostile government. Don't tell me there's no persecution for Christians today. Oh, we have it here, but it's so tame compared to what we're reading about and what other people are suffering. You know, you're suffering for a Christian today. What do you do on Sunday? You drive 100 miles to go to church? Watkins? Jensen? You could go to the San Diego beach and have a great time, and you drive to Bellflower? What's wrong with you? That's our persecution. Tough world, isn't it? Tough world. I suggest, my friends, that the fourth man never looked better, never showed himself more powerfully, nor more gloriously than when you see him and fire. That's when he shines. That's when you know how great and how good he is. Deliverance may come soon, may be delayed, but with Him, deliverance is certain.